Good morning, everyone. First, we are going to recognize and present an award to a longtime TMR member. And it took me, four or five months to get him here, which is why it wasn't done in the spring, which shows you how busy he is. Carol. I'm inviting Carol up because Carol's the one who nominated this gentleman, and it went before the Thursday Morning Roundtable Advisory Board, and it was unanimously voted on that he would be our recipient. So today we honor a true leader and a community volunteer. This TMR member has been described by a colleague as the most giving, caring, kind, generous person I have ever met. Our award recipient has served on numerous boards and committees, including the Central New York chapter of the American Diabetes Association, Onondaga Citizens League, the March of Dimes, the Rosamond Gifford Charitable Trust, the Rescue Mission, the United Way, and many more, believe it or not. The day after 9/11, this volunteer walked into the Fayetteville Fire Department to offer his assistance and has served as a volunteer there ever since. He often stays into the early hours of the morning before heading off to work. He is the recipient of many awards, including the Fayetteville Fire Department Chief's Award and the Fayetteville Fire Department President's Award and Top Responder Award. This award is given in honor of founder Lee Smith, who we are certain is smiling down upon his close friend. The Thursday Morning Roundtable is most pleased to present the award for meritorious community service to Patrick Mannion.
Well, hey, good morning, everybody. I can't even tell you what a blast this is to be back in front of this group. It's probably been well over a decade to be at the podium and sharing the stage. I said to David Dewar, it's great, I'm going to be sharing the stage with you and Juanita and with the folks that I spent so much time with back in TMR, unfortunately longer ago than I want to remember. I need to recognize my wife. Where's Gwen? I want everybody to know Lee Smith liked her way more than me. Just so Lee kept me around just so he could have close proximity to Gwen, and he was right. I want to say hello to my dad and the mayor. And I have two of my sons here who happen to be in Syracuse. The other four have flittered away to other locations. I have my son Michael, who works for AXA, and John, who's looking for a job, anybody who needs a 6'5" professional wrestler with other talents.
That's a skill.
It is a skill, like you, Juanita, it is. So many friendly faces, you know, Bob and Ed and everybody. It really brings back a flush of memories. I hope you'll indulge me for just a couple of minutes, because the gift you've really given me today isn't another plaque for the wall, but rather the opportunity to go back and remember Levi L. Smith. And many of us in the room, not everybody, but many of us in the room remember Lee. And it gave me a reason to go back and read my eulogy for Lee from 10 and a half years ago. He died in February of 2006, which I frankly just shocked me. By the way, many of us know Amelia Griner. Amelia passed away yesterday. And it's not a macabre thought. Amelia was just about 100 years old, one of the smartest, most willful people I ever had the pleasure of working with. She was a lot like Lee. She was never wrong. Didn't matter what she was saying, she was never wrong. And those of us in the room learned to accept that.
Not everybody.
Come on, we're talking about Amelia now here. All right, at least I rolled over every time Amelia said it. So we'll miss Amelia, but it's a great celebration today of Lee's life, for me anyway. And if you indulge me, I want to read some of my comments from that day 10 and a half years ago, because I found them to be inspirational and a great memory, and maybe you'll have great memories as well, from February of 2006. As I had the opportunity to spend time with Lee, first episodically and later quite regularly, I realized what charm and wisdom lay shallow below the surface of sarcasm, acerbic wit, and strong will. We developed a relationship that defied easy categorization. I learned from Lee every time I was around him. He seemed to enjoy my company, my politics, and maybe more than anything else, as he smiled knowingly at what he viewed as my pleasant, however unproductive, naivete. Lee was all-knowing. I always called him Dean Smith, a play on the basketball coach, and Lee certainly was a coach. But he was also an educator. He was first an educator, and second, a provocateur, and rarely did we know the difference. He was interested in the issues that meant something. He rejected form without substance. He didn't care who you were, what you did, what you were worth. What he cared about was what you did to make things better. He loved all of us. He loved his family. He loved his community. I had jotted down a note in my planner to call Lee on February 7th. It was time for us to have breakfast when Sandra Barrett, called and left me a message. I knew it wasn't good news. None of us get out of this alive, but that doesn't mean we think about life ending, either our own or our friends. I should have called Lee sooner, one day sooner, and he would have given me one last chance to share in the joy of his life. Another lesson learned from Lee, that is, procrastination pays no dividends, and never take life for granted. Levi is a great biblical name. He was the patriarch of one of the tribes of Israel. He was a fierce fighter, a man of short patience, and a great politician. He left an influential and magnificent legacy, including his progeny Moses. Who knows what Lee's parents were thinking when they gave him that name, but it turned out to be prophetic. Lee had a wonderful impact on countless people, and I am one of them. He did the same on the relationship between Syracuse University and Central New York. He was special to us all, and thus, we all will miss him. He was unique, and if I live to the same age as he, I will not experience another personal relationship like the one we had. And Lee, forgive me, but I thank the Almighty for having our paths cross and for giving me the opportunity to enjoy your company while I could. Thank you all for this recognition. It means a lot. And it would mean a lot if you think of Lee today and remember how he helped make all of our worlds a little better. Tanto nomine nullum par elogium. A man of such a great name, there are not words for his eulogy. L'chaim. Thank you.
Thank you, Patrick. And again, congratulations. So this morning we have a great panel discussion talking about the skills gap in the workplace. So our moderator today is Dr. Mike Evans, who teaches our intro and senior seminar courses in the Bachelor of Studies Professional Studies program through University College. He also teaches a leadership course. He is also an author and the founder of Evans & Associates Consulting Corporation. He works with numerous federal agencies and private firms providing professional and organizational development. Prior to his consulting career, Mike served as in the U.S. Navy Seabees as a field engineer and material logistics officer. He has degrees in policy studies, secondary education, public administration from SU, and his EdD in Leadership and Behavior Sciences from the University of Sarasota. Juanita Perez-Williams received her undergraduate and law degree from the University of California, San Diego. She, too, was in the Navy in Judge Advocate General's JAG program, where she attained the rank of Lieutenant Commander. She leads New York State's Office of Professional Discipline, was a member of the New York State's Attorney General's Executive Team, and the Corporation Council for the City of Syracuse. Presently, Juanita is the Regional Director for the Department of Labor in Central New York and a member of the governor's regional team. Her role is to advocate for workforce opportunities that support local employment and business prospects for small business owners in sustainable industry. David Doerr is the Vice President of Business Development for Empire Federal Credit Union. He served on the Board of Directors for over 10 years, joining the management team in 2011. David's prior experience includes 16 years with the Greater Syracuse Chamber of Commerce as Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer. He has also extensive experience in hospitality management. David is an active board member with Health Connections, United Way of Central New York, Longhouse Council for the Boy Scouts of America, Cornell Cooperative Extension, and Monarch Industries. David Freund is the Chief Leadership Officer at MACNE, the Manufacturers Association of New York. His background includes over 35 years of manufacturing experience. David began his time in manufacturing as a toolmaker's apprentice, and his last position was that of President of Self-Flock Screw Products. He serves on the boards of nonprofits, privately held companies, as well as a past member of Onondaga Central School Board. David is a certified executive coach, speaker, and trainer with the John Maxwell team. Please welcome our panel and our moderator.
Well, good morning, everybody. Beautiful day out here. As was mentioned, we're going to talk about some of the gaps in business, whether it's manufacturing, office setting, wherever it may be. What I'd like to start off with before we jump into this, and the plan is to have them speak, pose a question to them, have them speak for about a quarter of, and then turn it over to all of you to ask us questions, any questions that you may have. So, you know, I just got back from, it was mentioned that I do a lot of work, majority of my consulting work, I've been in business since 89, and it's all with the federal government. So the majority of it's with the Department of Defense. And I just got back, I had a group of individuals that were going through a year-long leadership development program, and I got back from Washington, and I had a graduation. And the question was posed to me, because they have a dialogue that goes on, so what is leadership? And I was thinking, geez, I hope they got it by now, right? We've been together for a year. And so, you know, and I thought about it for a second. You know, there's a lot of theories out there and lots of theorists out there, whether it's Maxwell, Carnegie, tons of other, Chris Arduous, tons of other individuals out there that talk about what leadership is. But I'm going to give you the Mike Evans definition. I kind of break it into what makes really a great leader, and a great leader has a combination of all these skills, which will bring us to our conversations here today. And so what makes our great leaders? A great leader, number one, has their technical skills that they bring to the table. So every one of you in here have what you're an expert at, or what we consider ourselves as an expert, what we go to work every day, or we had done as a profession every day. We go in and we do those tasks. So it's having that technical ability, whatever that may be. And that could be in manufacturing, as I mentioned before. It could be going into the office, managing individuals. It could be different components that we do. But it's the technical pieces that we bring to the table as individuals. The second thing that a great leader always brings to the table is the piece of emotional intelligence. And emotional intelligence falls really into four major categories. Number one is having self-awareness. So really having a great understanding of why we do what we do and understanding what's going on. The second part of emotional intelligence is self-management. So that's being able to control ourselves. So I was mentioning I live on a farm in Oneida, and we have 385 acres. It's been in my wife's family since 1864. And I have a big extension, a 10-foot by 70-foot extension going on the barn right now. And so it's all, and we have some issues going on as they were putting things up. They put a pole right in the middle of one of my doors. And I was like, well, that's going to be tough to drive through, right? So we have these communication things that were going on out there. So I had to manage myself, right? So when I talk about self-management as the second piece, it's about controlling those emotional impulses to say the wrong things. Like, you know, what kind of moron would put a pole in front of a door? So, and to be able to communicate effectively to do what? To get the results that I'm hoping for is not to have the pole in the middle of my door, but to have it moved out, but also keep the people that are working for me out there happy too, because I want them to continue to do a great job. So that's the second piece in emotional intelligence. The third piece is social awareness. So that's being able to recognize when something's not working right for other people around us. So when someone's off or they're feeling frustrated. And like I noticed that this contractor was feeling a little bit frustrated. So I opened up some dialogue with him. I said, is everything going well? I said, you're doing a really great job here. I'm really happy with everything. He goes, well, it doesn't seem like it. And I said, oh. Now, I could have walked away, and who wants to get into that conversation, right? And so I had to open up that dialogue, and that's that social awareness. And then the last piece of emotional intelligence that we bring to the table is relationship building. And in that dialogue we had, we built a relationship. I brought him out, I said, can I get you some guys some water? Can I bring you out some coffee? Would you like me to go down and get you some donuts or something else? So trying to build that relationship with those individuals. So people bring to the table technical ability and then emotional intelligence, which is those three pieces. But that's not enough, at least in my opinion. See, so the greatest of leaders are really aware of what their technical ability is, and they're in tune with their emotional intelligence all the time. But they also have to have balance. So it's finding that balance in their lives to be able to do all of that stuff. And that's what, if I look at some of the greatest leaders in our world, they're the individuals that find that balance. And for me, it's finding balance. And everybody has their own categories. Mine is finding a balance between family, between my work, between community stuff that I do, and between my faith. And so it's being able to find what is the right balance that makes all of that work, that allows me to excel at my technical ability and also continually heightened my emotional intelligence. So if I look at today out in society, and if I look at business, a lot of us come to the workplace and we're pretty good at that technical ability, but there are things that need to be refined when it comes to that. And a lot of sometimes that consists of areas around knowledge management. So that's how we take information and how we collect that information and how we make sure that when people are leaving, we're getting their information. So I assume some of you, as you move from position to position, some of you were put into a new position. Maybe you didn't get all the information. You kind of had to struggle your way through it. So knowledge management's an important piece. But then the creative leadership, which it works around looking at emotional intelligence, is important. So finding that balance is critical. But also being heightly aware of our technical abilities and our emotional intelligence is what truly makes a great organizations, is really what makes organizations successful, is when they have all of their individuals in their organization thinking in that mindset and making sure they clearly understand what that means in real terms, in real action. So I'm going to turn to our panel here and ask you all, as we think about these concepts of knowledge management, about how do you keep that information that's in the organization? How do you, when you have new people coming in, how do you give that information to them? But then also around the emotional intelligence, where do you see that importance of individuals being aware of themselves, being aware of how they manage themselves, being aware of others, and then ultimately building those relationships actually occurs within your organizations and is an important piece to all of us in our society in keeping businesses going? Because as small businesses, as we all know, make up our society, make up the economic piece of our society, it's a tough piece for small businesses sometimes to do too. So I will turn it over to you all. Whoever would like to go first.
Yeah, I could go first.
Sure.
I think, Mike, as you mentioned, leadership starts with leadership of self. Mm-hmm. And that becomes very important. I'm a big student of Carnegie's, as was mentioned earlier. And Dale would tell you, and this goes back 100 years ago, and I got a kick out of when Patrick came up, he mentioned that the topic in 1990 for Thursday Morning Roundtable was skills gap. So here we are 26 years later. Not a whole lot has changed. It was mentioned in our last session that we're all busy. And I've had a chance to kind of reflect on that since we had our last session. My grandfather was a farmer. He never took a vacation his entire life. There's a busy man. He was born in 1894 and died in 1960. This is not new that we're busy. But back to leadership of self, Carnegie would categorize all of us, and especially in this day and age, this may not sound politically correct, but he said that we're seen by the world in four ways. One, by what we do, right? Actions speak louder than words. One, by what we say, how we say it, and how we look to the world. So when we all say you can't judge a book by its cover, we all do judge books by their cover. So looks are important, our actions are important, what we say and how we say it are important. And it all begins with kind of a regimen or a disciplined self in order to lead other people the way we lead ourselves.
I wanted to offer, if you would indulge me for just a minute, how we got here, because the question itself assumes that we are really focusing more on maybe your soft skill, less than perhaps, or more than perhaps your hard skill, your trade, your actual operation of machinery and what have you. And here in Central New York, I think it's important to look at where we're going, because it clearly parallels with what we're talking about. So a year ago when we did this study, we were looking at whether or not this gap actually existed. What we didn't really focus on is what was that gap, what type of skill. So in 1 year's time since we did the study, we've come down a full point on unemployment. So we were at about 5.2 in the region. We're now at about 4.1. So that means more people are working. In the region, we had about 17,000, 17,500 people unemployed. We're down to under 16,000. So it looks like we're moving in this way where perhaps we would be filling this gap. But what we actually have in this region are more job openings. So a year ago, when we had maybe around 4,500, 4,800 job openings, we now have close to 6,000 job openings in Central New York that we're trying to fill, that Department of Labor and other entities within the region are having a difficult time. So we're looking at this gap. What is it? Well, we know that a number of these types of industries that are looking for work aren't really in those areas where a college degree or a lot of high-tech background is required. We've become a very service-oriented region. So you'll see high numbers of job openings in industries such as clerical, health assistants, social assistants, telecom assistants. That's you know, helping a business with its tech abilities. You see jobs such as retail up, some of our trades, our lower skilled trades. And this follows along with the rest of the United States. The United States has about 5.2 million job openings that they're trying to fill, but only about 100,000 of them are your high-tech skilled jobs, and many of them are not jobs that require college education. So I offer that because it really is something that we need to be talking about, because it is more about this soft skill. And we're seeing that with our employers, that they're looking at the information that we provide from the Department of Labor, the resumes, the skill sets. We work with veterans who have a number of skill sets. But what they're looking for is this ability to have people socialize with their customers, have an understanding of teamwork, have an understanding of analytics and working and assessing your product, your service. And so what we find ourselves doing is trying to, of course, respect those who have credentials and certification and what have you, but having them take a back step and look at what are they doing for in a volunteer arena? What are they doing in areas of working with others, showing the sense of empathy for their community and other types of organizations that you have here in Central New York? We're really trying to build a base of this social skill set of people who understand more than the work itself, and can they work with others? So we spend a lot of time on this, and a lot of it is this teamwork type of approach, and this approach to really understand a customer, a client, whatever your business is. And so, you know, I offer that, and that this is really a topic that's timely for this region because we see ourselves moving in that direction.
I'm glad that you started out with what you feel a leader needs to be, because Dale Carnegie, disciple, John Maxwell, disciple. So John would say that everything rises and falls on leadership. And so what is it? And everything that Juanita said is absolutely correct. somewhere, and depending on the thought leader that you're following or reading, sometime in the 60s and 70s, we lost the concept of true leadership in industry. And what I mean by that is that, one of John Maxwell's famous quotes is, people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And all of a sudden, we discovered this idea that our employees were expendable, that they really were just numbers, and they had an employee number, and if we needed to fix a balance sheet, we just got rid of employees. If we needed to strengthen our P&L, we just get rid of employees to make the quarter good, and we could always go find more. And all of a sudden, the employees started to realize that you know what? I don't matter to this organization. I'm just a number. So we wondered why they didn't want to work. We wondered why we had to put all kinds of strict work rules in place, why we needed to have, bells and things that told us when to go to work and when we could go to lunch and things like that. It was because management didn't really care about employees, so employees didn't really care about management. When I was younger, the idea was you go to work for a company and you stay there. When my dad was going, my dad was actually a die maker at Westinghouse, and it would have been this idea that you go work for Westinghouse and you retire from Westinghouse. You're a company man. Mm-hmm. But all of those things seem to go by the wayside. And I'm not saying that that's bad, that we don't stay at a company forever. I think it's actually good that we move around and we build our skills, but we've lost the concept that our employees matter. We should look at them almost as part of our family.
Right.
If we adopt children, we don't, if the family budget gets tight, get rid of the children. Yet, if companies, parents are raising their kids, they're sending their kids through our public school systems, and in some cases, they're sending them to universities, and then all of a sudden, they entrust us with these young people. These are their kids, and yet we don't treat them as though they're family members. I think if we would, we would be able to have followers that want to follow, not people that we're trying to herd like cats. The other thing is, and you talked about this emotional intelligence, so it really, if for even our employees, they need to be comfortable with who they are. And we have to let them know that it's okay for them to be who they are, not try to fit them into some mold. And one of the things that I think I missed for most of my, all of my manufacturing career, since I came out of it in the last 9 months, was that I would look at an employee and say, okay, this is what my company needs, and I need to fit you into that box, rather than taking a step back and saying, what does this employee want to do? The reality is that all of us, and David used Dale Carnegie's concept of that we really do judge people. Mm. We do. All of us do. If we want to try to tell ourselves we don't, fine, but we're not really very self-aware, because all of us pass judgment when we see people. But imagine how things would be different if on a scale of 1 to 10, we viewed everybody as a 10. We just haven't figured out what they're a 10 at yet. Just to give you an example where I wasn't really aware, and this is where I think one of my greatest failings as a leader was, the company that I ran for, that I was CEO for 12 years, and I was plant manager for 6 years before that, I had an employee. He was the son of the owner of the company. And I decided that this is what he had to be because it's their company. I have to make sure that this company's going to, the company's going to be turning 100 in 2020. I wanted to make sure that he's the oldest son, he's the engineer, he knows how to do all this stuff. Ryan, this is what you need to be. And I spent 5 years trying to make him something he didn't want to be. And so when I had this opportunity to go to join MACNI and I left, I transitioned out of the company. And as I was doing a lot of reflection on my time at SelfLock, I realized that I had done this young man very wrong. So I invited him to lunch. I said, I want to have lunch with you. And he came to lunch, and I said, I owe you an apology. And he goes, why? I said, I was trying to make you something that you never were going to be and never wanted to be. And that was wrong. Now, the interesting thing was, he said to me, he says, I owe you an apology. He said, I made your life miserable, and I didn't need to do that. Well, of course he was making my life miserable, because I was trying to force a square peg in a round hole. So I think one of the first things that leaders need to do is look at people as a 10 on a scale of 10 and try to determine What are they a 10 at?
Right. Mike, just to piggyback on that, we had a conversation at MACNA yesterday with Indium Corporation out of Clinton, New York, 600 employees. They've been around since 1934. And just quickly, what they surmised that go along with what David is saying is lead with purpose, manage with heart. They have grasped this concept where people matter at that company, and it's a tremendous company, very, very, very successful. And I would say it's because of that leadership philosophy.
I'd offer another great example. We all heard about what Chobani did a couple of days ago. I mean, an amazing company. Mr. Ulukaya came from Turkey in the early 90s, not that long ago, with a small, a farm experience, comes here to learn English. His dad tells him, milk and cheese, do something with it. And turned a small operation where he had very little skill set into this billion-dollar company, but with his history, with his story, with his background, he has made these wonderful announcements for all 2,000 of his employees, the most recent one the other day being that he's going to provide 6 weeks of parental leave for every employee, whether you're hourly, salaried, whatever your position is in the company. And he offered that this needs to be the example of business leadership. This needs to be what we're doing in this country for our employees and for being good leaders in the community. And I think we should applaud his efforts.
A question just to follow up, and I'm going to open it up to the audience. So, you've some of the conversation you have, so it's not on my list of questions that I gave you, so here's a wild one. So as you were talking, I was thinking about it, that we're talking about some of the gaps that are out there currently, and we're talking about how we communicate differently, and communication is completely different now. And so how do you and your organizations currently address those things, and what do you think as a community we should be doing more of to address those? So there's your hot question, and then I'm going to turn it open to the audience to ask some questions.
I could.
I know, but that's what happens, right?
Yeah.
Up here, and I started thinking.
To elaborate on the challenge itself, though, we were talking earlier with social media today. So much of it is texting or just words, and of course, many of us in the room know, with all of our experience, that words are a very, very minor part of communication. It's been studied ad nauseum, and as it turns out, only 7% of what we say to each other are just our words. So much of it is body language, tone, inflection, and so forth. So can you imagine just texting someone words? Right away there can be instant communication problems. I think Mike was saying earlier that if you are having two texts or two emails and someone does not understand what you're saying, you've got to pick up the phone, or you've got to meet them in person. So it's a very big challenge for us. We're a 475-person employer with 20-some branches in 9 different counties. So communication plays a very, very key role. So we do try to, even simple things in email, we don't allow bolding and capitalization, where you can attempt to show some emotion in the words. We really do want people to meet face to face, or at least be on the phone. So we're a work in progress.
I'd offer the same thing. I mean, we see when, again, going back to this idea of trying to support the employee that we're trying to match with an employer with some soft skills that we know are required. Communication is always a factor. We're always trying to take a skill set and offer to the applicant how they can display themselves on paper or what have you. But it made me think of a funny story, because in doing this, often what we have are employers who have an expectation that the individuals that we send them will have an understanding of some of their requirements, such as having good communication skills. So what you have now, many employers, even at your lowest skilled opportunities, require you to apply online. And they'll assess you based on something that they receive online prior to actually meeting you. And they make their decisions. And so we had a particular employer in Syracuse. It was very interesting that they required, even at a low skilled level, this idea of being able to work with people, communicate, and what have you. And so a number of applications came in with this skill set. And once they met these individuals and started talking to them, they learned that many of them did not have English as a first language, which, when looking at the paperwork that was coming in online, communication was obviously essential. And what we learned is that this group of individuals that had come together to apply for these positions had actually worked with a librarian at one of our local libraries who had helped them submit their applications and knew that communications was a big piece of it, and so offered in their paperwork what they could do. Never mentioned that, in fact, English wasn't their first language, but it just showed you, just by looking at something with regard to an online process, that you may miss something. And we need to go back to a formality that's more about meeting people and not making these assessments based on receiving information in a process, whether it's texting, whether it's email, whatever the case is.
It's interesting when you talk about the piece on communications, because I don't know if you remember the NBC News special or segment on Chobani when Hamdi decided that he was going to give his employees that had been with him stock in the company whenever, so that when it went public, they would be part of that growth in wealth. And I remember just watching, because I've done quite a bit of training at Chobani, and I remember watching employees just come up and hug him. Probably not, you know, HR correct or whatever, but anyways, he was hugging him. And the interesting thing, so when we talked about communication to Chobani, they have several hundred Burmese refugees that work there in the two plants in New Berlin and in Norwich. So you wonder, well, I can't, and so the good part is that only 7% of our communication is words. The rest is our tone of voice and our body language. And you know, one of the things that I learned too late in life was another quote that walks slowly through the crowd. If you're managing people, if you're leading people, you got to walk slowly through the crowd. The problem is that managers don't. Management is very transactional. So we go from point A to point B to complete a task. Leadership is transformational. And when you walk slowly through the crowd, you have time to make eye contact with people. And that's a skill that all of us need to work on. It used to be more prevalent because we kind of grew up eating dinner around the table together. We interacted with our family all the time. I don't know how many families eat dinner together anymore. You know, kids, what's tragic, you go into a restaurant and you see a family eating dinner and there's five phones out and nobody's talking to anybody. The worst one was my wife and I went for a short, long weekend up to Niagara on the lake, and we go to this very nice restaurant, and here's this young couple sitting at the table, each of them looking at their phones.
They're texting each other.
They might be.
I love you more.
I love you more.
So somehow we need to really help, specifically our young people, understand that, you know what, it's about getting to know people. It's about making eye contact with people. It's about being comfortable in your own skin so that you can really relate with people. Because there is not a job that I have found in any business, factory, whatever, where you don't need to at some point talk to people.
Well, great point. You know, a few times it's been brought up about the communication aspect around how we actually communicate with other individuals. So the stats will show you the three things is worth mentioning: body language, tone of voice, and the content you say. So you can think back to all the situations, all of you, that you've been in, and when situations have gone maybe not to the right way sometimes at points, but 67% of what you project to people is your body language. So like when my wife says to me, honey, what do you think about the dress that I'm wearing? And I say to my wife, that's a real beautiful dress. What did you interpret? Not too hot, right? All right, so when I'm out in the barn with the animals that evening, it wasn't the words that I said. So it's important, I think, for us to realize that is going on. And then also with the communication aspect of it, there's lots of components with communication, but one of the most critical pieces that we lack as a society, our society, is the listening aspect. And so we come to judgment very quickly. As we said, we see the cover, we judge things by what it looks like. But it's not our fault. as individuals when it comes to communication, because that's how you've been trained. So ever since you started in primary education to secondary, if you went on further than that, unless you took some formal classes, I mean, we're seeing some progression in the schools where it's changing a little bit now, but unless you took some formal classes, I'm looking at the age of individuals, and I'm sure all of you, none of you had formal classes in listening. I went to a parochial school, and all I had was a nun cracking me in the back of the head telling me to shut up and listen and turn around. So, but you're all were taught how to problem solve. That's it. We were taught how to problem solve. So you all learned how to read, all learned how to write, and when we write, we may take words, we put them into sentences to make paragraphs, to make comprehension. Same process when we read. So the listening aspect really doesn't come natural to us as individuals, and we need to be conscious of that in that communication process that we're having with individuals, that how we see it and how we perceive listening makes sense. A lot of times it doesn't for others. But I think it's a great point that have been made here about the gaps that are out there that we see right now. And studies will show that this interpersonal thing, when individuals in businesses are asking, what do you want from individuals? They want individuals to have some of these interpersonal skills, to have an awareness of themselves, to have an awareness of what they do, and to be able to have the ability to understand what's going on with other people and to be able to develop those relationships with individuals. But I'd like to turn it out to the audience if you have any questions or your thoughts on this.
I liked your whole definition and explanation of leadership as you see it and all the necessary ingredients. What seemed to be missing for me is something I've always felt that it was essential, is that leaders have to have a dream to make dreams come true. So whether you call it dream, a goal, objective, whatever you want to call it, if you don't have that, how do you get from A to B to C? And you got to integrate all the things you talked about here in terms of working with your people. Where do you fit in having goals and objectives?
You know, for myself, that fits right into that piece when I'm looking to make that balance. So when I'm looking at that balance, I'm asking myself, what do I need to achieve in those areas? What's important to me, and where do my values fall into place? So my values really drive that vision for me of where I'm going to be. So like at this stage in my life, I'm semi-retired, so I teach for Syracuse a few courses, and I have my business, but I'm really picking and choosing what I do at this point. Because my values, I want to spend more time at home rather than being on the road. So that drives my vision of where I'm going to end up at in these different places. And that vision changes continuously. So when things get thrown out at us and we have these challenges that occur, that vision or that direction ends up moving. But it's always about within that balance that I'm trying to find balance in life, my vision goes. But I'll let others speak to this.
And certainly, Ed, I'm in business development with Empower, so we have objectives. I totally agree with what you're saying. I guess for us, it goes without saying. We measure number of companies that we're working with, the number of times we visit them, the number of members that we're generating, and how satisfied those members are. So absolutely, if you don't have a destination or a goal, it would be difficult to get there. So you're absolutely right. That's a key component. Being able to lead the group.
I think what we focus on when we're working with applicants and business leaders is this idea that often those goals can change, and to not, you know, to be flexible, especially when the economy changes and skill set requirements change. And so we're always focusing on keeping that list, knowing what it is, but knowing that it's going to change, especially with your applicants who often are transitioning from one position to another. Knowing that their goals could change based on whatever the requirement is for that employer, but that this is something that's constantly in motion. We worked with an employer recently who had to work on taking some of his employees with a lower skill set and move them up to sustain his company. And this was all because his goals had changed with regard to his manufacturing, what he was producing. And that's happening more and more. And so what again, I think is important is that when people identify what they are, to not be so structured that there's not movement and fluidity with regard to how these things change with the economy.
And the way manufacturing is changing, because that's the industry that I can speak to. You know, everything is evolving so quickly. So the vision, and since we've already heard some reference to some biblical truths, where there is no vision, the people perish. So there has to be a dream. You know, every good leader has a dream. Martin Luther King Jr. didn't stand up at the Mall in Washington and say, I have a plan. He said, I have a dream, and he articulated that dream, and people bought into his dream. For me, when I was at Selflock, my goal was to prepare, you know, I felt I was a custodian of this business. It wasn't my family business. Make sure that it is positioned for its next century of existence. Solidify the balance sheet, get the equipment, get the right people. But then I realized that, you know, that was part of it. What really was my dream was to make a difference and add value to people. Good. Now, that's also why I ended up at one point realizing it was time for me to move from that position where I was. It's in good hands. The owner's still there. There's managers in place to run the business. But my assessment of my vision shifted so that I could do more than just that one company. But you have to have a dream.
Good morning. I've gotten a couple mixed messages, I think. One message is there's very limited opportunity for people with high skills to stay in the area, but somehow we need to make people with lower skills much more pleasant so they can work for minimum wage jobs. So we've got a whole bunch of leaders in the community trying to keep the college-educated kids here where there are few chances, and yet we have nobody in the community working to make poorly skilled people happy so they'll do personal care work.
If I can just answer that one. So in manufacturing, we don't have enough high-skilled people either. When I was running Selflock, our business growth was constrained by the fact that I could not find precision machinists to run machines. I was meeting with someone else this week. I do an executive roundtable, and this CEO, a young woman from a company just east of us, she said, I can't grow my business because I can't find the technical people to run it. Engineers, all of the STEM professions, we don't have enough of them. So that assessment, if we gave that impression, I'm sorry, we shouldn't have. The reality is, too, that we still need those lesser skilled. And, you know, when I talk about a lesser skilled job, I'm not talking about a minimum wage job. I'm talking about somebody that's a more technician level in a manufacturing environment as opposed to an engineer or that highly skilled tradesperson like the precision machinist.
You know, and I think there's a great opportunity for, I mean, we hear this a lot, there's just not enough individuals, change my wording, too many individuals are being pushed, and Syracuse probably wouldn't like me saying this, being pushed to go to college when we need trade individuals out there. We need individuals to offer more opportunities for individuals to be able to learn these trades that are out there. And most of those trades, they make more money than I could possibly make. And I'll tell you, that's a real quick story. I'll tell you that when I was in high school, I went to East Syracuse Manoah High School. I grew up in the area here. And I was in ninth grade. I was going into 10th grade. And the guidance counselor called me down. And she says, you're not smart enough to go to college. You'll never make it. She's looking at my grades. And I said, oh. She goes, you need to go to BOCES. And I said, what's BOCES? She goes, and BOCES is a lot different than it was when I was a young lad. And she goes, you need to pick a trade. And I said, oh. I said, okay. I said, well, what do you got? And she gave me a list. And I said, okay, I'll let you know. No. I need to know now. I need to get this off my platter. And I said, I don't know. I'll do welding. So I went to BOCES for 2 years and learned how to weld. And I went into the Seabees. And I was a civil engineer. And it was probably, and I learned a lot when I was in the Seabees, a lot about construction stuff. There isn't anything I could do. I could build a house now if I wanted to. So what I'm offering, what I'm saying here is that I think we need to encourage. So when we talk about these minimum wage jobs that are out there, and I know we do some of this, I don't think we do enough of this. I think there's too much push that everybody should go to college. And maybe college isn't at that moment the right thing for everybody. And so trying to look what's going to fit the best for individuals. And as I said, these trade jobs pay more than a lot of what you consider professional jobs that people are thinking they're going to get when they get out of college. I can tell you myself, the debt that I have of my college degrees is enormous. And as time goes on, you know, I'm thinking about my daughter. I'm thinking, my gosh, it's going to probably run me like $300,000 by the time she have a 10-year-old. We got started late, surprise. And so those considerations, I think we can do something more as a community and society to help individuals out.
Mike, can I add? So when I was in high school, they told me I was lazy, and I didn't care. So there was no way that I was going to think about going to college because I'm lazy, I don't care, and I can't do it. So I became an apprentice toolmaker. My dad had been a die maker before going into manufacturing. I became an apprentice toolmaker. I ended up running a company. What I found out later in life, after I had a son that my wife and I told was lazy and didn't care, he was our third child. Our first two kids excelled when they were in school. Jeremy didn't. And when he flunked out of Krause's nursing school and then reapplied and they accepted him back in because his clinical evaluations were so exceptional, they let him back in, they realized he had learning disabilities. So I remember him coming home, and I felt, you can imagine how low I felt as the father that said, you're lazy, you don't care. And I rode him, you know, almost into the ground trying to get him to care. Once they discovered exactly what was going on in this poor young man's mind, the way he learned, the way he processed things, the way he took tests, I started listening to what was happening. And I said to him, I said, Jeremy, that's me. You know, I'm the one that starts to sweat if I'm going to do a CPR recertification. Because whenever I'm in a testing environment, I short circuit. So they figured out what to do with Jeremy, how to help him learn. And 3 weeks ago, Jeremy became Krause's clinical educator for the ICU and the neuro ICU, which I think is pretty amazing. Thank you. You know, once he figured it out, he graduated from Krause's School of Nursing, got his, you know, passed his boards, became a nationally certified critical care nurse, and now is teaching. So my point is, some of these young people, we're not even sure. Because we didn't put a 10 on scale of 1 to 10. We made him a 3 or a 4.
Based by the book.
You know, somebody was putting you, they should have made you a 10. I love the fact that now you're teaching at a university. If only your guidance counselor could see you now.
Can I respond to that? Because I just wanted to get an opportunity here. Because I agree with everything that David is saying, but the question really goes to people who have that opportunity, to have an opportunity to work on whatever skill set is necessary in the region, and what we find, and I think what we're finding, it's really twofold. So I don't know about any of you, but when I was in high school and college, I worked, right? I flipped hamburgers, I cleaned houses, I did what I had to do. A lot of us did that. That's where you got a lot of your basic soft skills, right? You learned how to work with people. You learned how to deal with crisis. You learned how to keep your mouth closed when the boss said, keep your mouth closed, you know? You showed up to work. You know, I opened breakfast and then went to school at McDonald's. We have a whole generation of kids that are going to college that don't work and haven't had this experience. So I wouldn't offer to you that there's a lack of opportunity. What I would offer to you is that we have a generation of people who are lacking another skill other than their education. I'll give you a very good example. I've been working with an electrical engineer. You're right, we need them. He got a job a few weeks ago, called me up laughing. Small company, they take turns mowing the lawn, small front yard of the company. He had to go out and get a lawnmower. He didn't know how to use one. Electrical engineer. I mean, it's talking about these other skills that I think a lot of us maybe attained when we were, you know, so you have that issue. But then you also have this issue of, and we can talk all day about that, is poverty. And people who don't have the opportunity to learn these skill sets with the background of their family life or lack thereof, the ability to have empathy, the ability to understand others, the ability to work together, to deal with crisis. I mean, we learn this when we go through different levels of unemployment, even if our goals are to become lawyers or doctors or whatever the case is. If we're not offering that, we lose this whole setting that employers are looking for, companies are looking for with regards to this emotional intelligence or whatever you want to call it. We don't have that for different types of people in our setting today. And I'd offer to you that when you get these one-on-one opportunities, they're great. A lot of people don't get them.
I was wondering, I agree with what you're saying as far as the leadership type thing would be concerned, but I couldn't help but thinking here that the Syracuse area, has a difficult time making community decisions. And I'm thinking in terms of community leadership. Can we transfer some of the things you're talking about so that we have a better process for making important decisions within the community? Back in the old days, the 1940s or 1950s, it was easy for the community here to make decisions. They had power brokers and so on. Today, it seems very difficult. It's very splintered. And I was wondering if there's some way of maybe working on the idea of community leadership, using the skills that we could develop to produce that.
We have to reinvest in our neighborhoods. We have to reinvest in people. Community leaders need to think about the fact that people are not working and have never worked. Generational poverty is impacting this city, and it's impacting those who even have opportunities. So I don't want to be the only one with answers to this, but community leadership needs to transfer over into neighborhood leadership, and this sense of people working. People need to work.
David, then we'll go to the next question.
Yeah, Clyde, I would suggest that it's easy, basic, and fundamental. It comes down to communication. The leaders of the city, the county, I know what you're talking about. I look at the lakefront development. It was 1988, Conjo was talking about 880 acres. There's no oil tanks now, but if you forgive me, it's 28 years later. Why would it take that long? We built a convention center in 1992. We don't open the hotel until 2016. Why would it take 24 years to put some beds near a place where people meet? I would dare say it's not as hard as anyone thinks here. It's communication, very, very fundamental. If we could just get back to talking to one another, we would do a lot. Thanks, Clyde.
Good morning, and thank you all for your thoughtful comments this morning. I wanted to ask a question. Juanita, earlier you alluded to the OCL study on the skills gap, which was a year ago or a little bit more than a year ago. One of the things I believe that we discovered in that process was what we saw as sort of a misalignment between skills and opportunities. And one of the things you've already mentioned that we felt we could attribute that misalignment to was the use of online applications. But I wonder if you could speak to HR processes and third-party hiring, because I know that we often find those of us that have worked in workforce development or work with people who are looking for work or jobs, that at the top levels, when we talk to managers or supervisors who've gone through leadership training, they're open to these kinds of ideas about matching people with skills and opportunities in interesting ways. But at the level of the HR teams or the third parties that, you know, that do hiring on that end, and a lot of companies use those parties, we find that there's not as much room for that kind of creativity. So I just wondered if you could speak to that or if you see any companies where there is, you know, something amazing going on in that way.
We've seen an adjustment in the way that employers are at least not only finding employees, but employees that they can keep and stay with the company and what have you. But we're trying to move people away from online hiring and simply waiting for applicants to come through that process, because many people don't utilize that process. And it's not a way to really get to know people. So you will see, and you probably have heard, there are numbers of job fairs that have been happening throughout the region. We did a very successful one with Hotel Syracuse. We do events for employers, just their companies, where we invite applicants who seem to have skill sets that match the actual job opportunities, and then they can have a one-on-one conversation with each of the applicants. Smaller pools, 10, 15 people. But just moving away from a way where you're meeting people through, you know, a computer, it doesn't seem to work. And what we find are people don't last, and there's not a relationship that can really happen prior to hiring. So we've done a lot of one-on-one support with employers, and we've pushed HR leaders to look at, you know, possibilities of inviting people into the workplace and just doing, you know, again, a one-on-one job matching and seeing if, in fact, you know, there's a connection made. Hotel Syracuse did one that was phenomenal. But we learned through that. We did a process that was online, and that's how we were going to match people. For 200 jobs, we had 800 people apply. And everyone went, wow. When we actually had the day where we were going to do these one-on-one interviews, 1,200 people showed up. So we had 400 people who didn't even know to go online. And then when we got there, we had 1,200 people who were interested in these jobs and were ready to have that one-on-one conversation. We managed to do it in a 12-hour day, and a lot of people volunteered to do it. But I think if you look at the staff and who they have there now, it really was very worthwhile. But they took the time to try and meet people, talk with people, and move away from a system where there's really no connection.
Okay, unfortunately, we're out of time. Thank you so much to our panelists. This discussion could go on much longer, but unfortunately, we all have other places to be, I think. Thank you very much.
Jeff.